up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule, American history and practical math. You study them hard and hoping to pass, working your fingers right down to the bone. And the guy behind you won't leave you alone. Ring, ring goes the bell.
Many of us can look back on our high school days as a kind of a blur of early morning wake-ups that launched us into our day, with those first few hours as our least favorite and least productive of the whole day. Now there's research to affirm what many might have suspected, that adolescents in particular are just not morning people. Dr. Jim Shan, executive director of the Hawaii Educational Policy Center, has looked at the research and wonders why it hasn't been applied here. He's with us in our studio. Hi, Jim. Thanks for coming in.
Good to be here.
Anything that allows us to lead off with a Chuck Berry song is...
Yeah, that was good enough. Now, can I go now?
No.
Okay.
We have to build on that now.
Okay.
But, you know, the whole idea of how your brain works at certain hours of the day is getting explored in greater detail.
That's right. You've got a young person going through a growth spurt who needs 8 hours of sleep. So regardless of your biorhythms and everything else,
right,
if you're not getting enough sleep, you're not really going to be as productive as you could anyway, right? Mm-hmm. Secondly, what you alluded to is the adolescent mind is a nocturnal mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are awake at midnight, raring mm-hmm. to go, right?
Yeah.
But in the early morning, they are not. And this, there seems to be some evidence this is not just American kids. This is like a universal aspect of adolescent development. Right?
This is just human development, period.
That's exactly right. Now, on top of that, they get to school, 8 o'clock, it's time for Algebra 3, right? All the hard stuff is packed in early, right?
Yeah.
And these kids are just like groggy as can be. And then when you add other routine aspects of our industrial factory-like schools.
Right.
Every classroom's the same. Every class is 42 minutes. The little chairs are in little rows. They're not in circles to engage each other, right? You've got the trifecta or whatever of boredom, sleepiness.
Routine.
Routine. These are things that are not created for optimum learning by those students,
yeah.
right? And then when you add our traffic problems as well, right?
Yeah.
Now, we do know that some schools in Hawaii have begun to inch along in that way. Kaimuki High has done that, right? They moved their start time back an hour, right, from 8 o'clock to about 9 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
They do not have to rely on a DOE bus system. So anybody gets their... Either their parents drop them off, or they walk, or they take the city buses.
Because it's in a neighborhood, you mean?
That's right, because in an urban area,
the physical layout of...
That's right. Yeah. And the other thing is that we insist that every day be the same. You know, some people are intimidated by the notion of, oh, what a logistical nightmare to shift our entire school every day later. Why don't you just try Wednesday, you know?
Yeah.
Wednesday is a short day anyway, you know?
Uh-huh.
1:30, get out of here. We seem to be bound up in this notion that any incremental change based on research has to be comprehensive. And this is a little bit of the tyranny of the comprehensive, I think.
Uh-huh.
We need to encourage more experimentation. We need to encourage and give schools some resources. Well, now that we're doing this, let's see if we can determine, are the students brighter? Are the teachers reporting they're more alert? They're learning better? Are they still sleeping at their desks, you know, at 9:30? There's a lot of ways that we can be more intentional and directional in looking at serious research that relates to learning. We're so into reducing the gaps on big tests.
Yeah.
But when it comes to how we structure our school and how we deal with time, sometimes we're a little asleep ourselves.
Well, Jim, you hit on something which is I've observed more than once in the educational community, which is the results of a study are released, and then they get studied.
That's right.
right? But wait a minute, didn't it just get studied? Do we then proceed from this finding? Or, you know, why do you study a finding? It's a finding. That's why they call it that, right?
Yeah. We'll wait a few years and give me $1 million, and we'll study it to update the last study, right? Uh-huh. Which we did nothing about, right?
Frequently, which lead to a fairly intuitive conclusion that where you know, at the end of all this, you say, hey, I could have told you that.
That's right. There's a kind of duh, you know, moment there that every parent knows, right?
Yeah.
And I think that one of the aspects of it is that if a school has the authority and the power at the school level and the encouragement to experiment, more of them will. Mm-hmm. But right now we don't have a system where we really have decentralized decision making, which is true in the charter schools but not true in our DOE schools that much.
Yeah.
The fact that Kaimuki and one or two others have begun doing it anyway shows there's maybe a little more cultural barrier and institutional thought barrier than real barriers to this kind of change. But if we're serious about these young people emerging as future citizens and members of our workforce and whatnot, who have not just slept through some of the more consequential classes.
Yeah.
If we're serious about that, we have to be serious about this kind of research. This is biology. This is science.
What you're talking about on one level is a kind of institutional flexibility. And as you well know, institutions, as they grow, tend to move away from flexibility because they develop an institutional culture, and then within that culture, thou shalt obey. Yeah.
That's right. And big systems and big schools, and by the way, on average, we have some of the largest schools by enrollment in the nation, right? When you've got 3,000 students on campus, right, the logistical mandates of just getting through the day
and
all the schedules and all that, this takes over the prerequisites, the priorities of good learning environments, right? When you have smaller schools, smaller learning communities, and by the way, Kaimuki is interesting because they have had their enrollment shrink. So they've actually had a lot of not only physical but educational space to experiment. Mm-hmm. They have several academies broken down their school into subcategories, right? So this smaller learning community realm gives you the opportunity to experiment.
They're going small and benefiting from it, presumably.
Small is beautiful. You have Schumacher.
Is that an educational principle?
Oh, well, that was a famous book in the 60s or so, Small is Beautiful, and it's part of that trend of grassroots movements.
What would it take to, you know, bring about the kind of changes you're talking about?
Well, I think the Board of Education, through its various plans and whatnot, has to be much more intentional and focused. We want you to take risks in these areas, right? I think there may be some discussion that would have to happen in collective bargaining to make sure that, you know, that wasn't getting in the way with number of classes taught and everything like that. But I also think real empowerment by the school councils in our DOE, somewhat similar to what the charters have, gives people the opportunity. It won't guarantee it, but the opportunity to say, yeah, let's try this. And if the board and the new superintendent do not slap their hand for failing, right, you have to have permission to fail in order to learn.
We'll be talking to Beth Ann will be talking to the superintendent of schools tomorrow, so we'll see if this gets
Ask
brought
her
up.
Ask her about that.
Thanks a lot, Jim.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Jim Shawn has been a Peace Corps teacher, is a 12-year state legislator, and currently executive director of the Hawaii Educational Policy Center.